Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipsack. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. You can get some notebook, paper, and pens to take notes during the show. We start out with some debt-related news and facts for the week. And an article from Reason.com by Greg Beato. Collection agencies use the criminal justice system to pocket credit card debts. The article is called The Return of the Debtor's Prison. As you know, back in England, that was a standard way to try to get money out of people by putting them in jail. Now we're seeing some of this kind of response through the legal system in America. According to Michael Klozotsky, managing editor of the trade publication InsideArm.com, debt collectors contact consumers approximately 4 billion times a year. With so many contacts, there are bound to be complaints. In 2009, the Federal Trade Commission, FTC, received 88,190 consumer complaints about third-party debt collectors. That's not the original creditor, that's somebody else. More than 2,500 of these involved collectors who used threats of violence or actual violence while plying their trade. Another 11,505 involved false threats of arrest or property seizure. Approximately zero involved one of the more egregious aspects of debt collection, the way the industry outsources collection efforts to the civil court system, using taxpayer money and government force to strong-arm nickels from low-level deadbeats. In 2007, third-party collection agencies returned over $40 billion to original creditors via collection efforts, Klozotsky said. He's making a case for the virtues of debt collection, and this is his most pervasive talking point. Those recovered billions increase the availability of credit to all consumers and help keep interest rates in check. But the persistent phone calls and dunning letters that collection agencies deploy on debtors only pack so much punch. More and more creditors are retaining the services of attorneys to file lawsuits on their behalf in civil court. At an FTC roundtable in 2009, Ira Liebsker, a Chicago collection attorney, estimated that there were probably tens of millions of lawsuits underway at that time. That same year, a single company, Encore Capital Group, filed 375,000 suits in the United States. According to Debt Deception, a report published by the Legal Aid Society and several other advocacy organizations in May 2010, the 26 largest debt buyers in New York City filed 457,322 lawsuits from January 2006 through July 2008. This huge infusion of cases exposes thousands of individuals to a process that overwhelmingly favors plaintiffs. Indeed, in debt collection cases, you're basically guilty until proven innocent. Part of the problem stems from the way the debt buying industry has evolved over the last 20 years. And again, I underline it's a debt buying industry. As recently as the early 1990s, many credit card issuers made little effort to collect on their past due accounts. If a cardholder missed a payment or two, in-house collection efforts would generally follow. But when a cardholder hadn't made a payment in 180 days, issuers tended to charge off the delinquent account against earnings, settle for the tax break, and pursue collection efforts no further. Now, there are companies that purchase portfolios of delinquent debt for pennies on the dollar, then attempt to collect. According to Debt Machine, a report produced by the National Consumer Law Center, debt buyers bought receivables worth $6 billion in face value in 1993. By 2005, that number had grown to $110 billion. Debts migrate from seller to buyer, often with very little information attached to them. What they're buying is a spreadsheet full of data, names, addresses, account numbers, and balances, says Fred W. Schwinn, an attorney at the Consumer Law Center, Inc. in San Jose, California. Applications, original contracts, transaction histories. Plaintiffs don't need any of these documents to file a lawsuit. You don't have to attach assignment documents of any kind, says Schwinn. You just say, I bought an account with a balance of $10,000. This person owes me the money. You file the complaint, you get service on the defendant, and the courts will grant a judgment on that. In the bulk of these cases, defendants don't show up and the judge simply issues default judgments against them. In many cases, they fail to show because they're hoping haplessly to avoid paying debts they owe. In others, they simply don't know they're being sued. I get people in our office every week who say, my paycheck just got garnished and I've never been served for anything, says Schwinn. Come to find out, they were substitute served at an address they haven't lived at in 3 or 4 years. The processor knocks on the door and asks for so-and-so, and the person says, I never heard of that person. And the processor just drops the paperwork on the porch and walks away. In the early years of America, debt was an inescapable fact of life, the historian Bruce H. Mann writes in Republic of Debtors, his 2002 account of how the new nation reconciled its ideals of republican independence with the pervasive indebtedness that plagued its citizens. Over time, he shows, insolvency shifted in meaning from sin to risk, from moral failure to economic failure, and bankruptcy laws and the eventual abolition of debtors' prisons offered the insolvent a chance to free themselves from past failures and misfortunes. While this shift in meaning applied more to commercial debt than personal ones, we see its echo in today's statute of limitations on credit card debts. Simply put, America doesn't want to stay in debt forever. While statutes of limitations differ from state to state, more than half give creditors just 3 to 5 years to sue debtors for non-payment. If they miss that window, a debtor is under no legal obligation to repay his debt. If a creditor sues and obtains a judgment, however, any ideals of republican independence, fresh starts, and forgiveness quickly go out the window. In California, for example, judgments are enforceable for 10 years, then renewable for another 10 years, then renewable after that under certain conditions. Interest accrues at 10% per annum. Wages can be garnished, bank accounts frozen, property seized. A debt originally incurred by someone whose name is similar to yours can become a lifelong commitment. Simply because you ignored a few letters from a company whose name you didn't recognize that said you owed it money. That's a worst case scenario. But as cases get rubber stamped by judges and clerks, autopiloting their way through the daily deluge of lawsuits, it happens. Then there's an unfortunate fellow in Kenny, Illinois. In January, a judge sentenced him to indefinite incarceration until he paid $300 toward a debt he owed to a lumberyard. Originally reported in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the case is an extreme example of a practice that, while rare, is apparently happening more frequently. The Star Tribune reports that the use of arrest warrants against debtors has jumped 60% over the past 4 years, with 845 cases in Minnesota in 2009. When a judge issues a judgment against the debtor is supposed to complete a financial disclosure form that will provide the information a creditor needs to collect his debt. If the debtor fails to do so, the creditor can obtain a court order to compel the debtor to show up in court to explain why he hasn't. If the debtor fails to show up for this hearing, then a judge can issue a contempt of court order and a warrant for the person's arrest. And that's the critical point, giving the court the information it requires and requests. It's the same process the court system uses to imprison individuals who fall behind on child support. In the mid-1990s, a hospital in Illinois started practicing this tactic as well. Over the last decade, at least 4 people around the country have actually been arrested and at least briefly detained for their failure to pay library fines. Debtors have also been arrested and jailed in Arkansas, Arizona, Illinois, Indiana, Massachusetts, Washington, Florida, and New Jersey. While the official charge is contempt of court, judges sometimes set the bail to the exact amount the debtor owes. When he pays it, it can go straight to the creditor's coffers. At a time when the federal government has spent hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out big businesses, it's a travesty that state and local governments are using the full force of their power to shake down private citizens on behalf of debt collectors, especially when many of those debts have been acquired for less than it costs to incarcerate a small-time deadbeat for a long afternoon, much less indefinitely. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So I've been doing an article from the Boston Globe for the last month or so regarding debt collection, and I want to continue that now. The article and the series was generally called Debtor's Hell, and today we're going to look at Behind the Badge. But the first thing I want to discuss a little bit is the upfront article I just read about debtors' prisons. I want to point out right from the beginning that we don't really have the concept of going to jail for debt re-enlivened in America. People are going to jail, but the reason they can go to jail in relationship to a debt is that they do not follow court orders. People often get a judgment against them, whether they show up or it's a default judgment, and that creates a legal court enforceable order for collecting the debt. That in and of itself usually isn't the issue. The issue is in most states, what follows from that is an attempt to find out what the debtor owns, where he or she works. Those kinds of items that can be attached, levied upon, executed upon by the creditor to get their money. To do that, there is often a procedure through the court system to do interrogatories, deposition. In other words, to discover what the person owns and to try to collect against those things. When that particular notice is given to the debtor to show up in court and give that information, and then they do not show up, they are in direct violation of a court order. The court then is not very happy and can issue an arrest warrant for that person. And this can be a very horrible and nightmarish situation because of a variety of reasons, how those lawsuits happened in the first place, without proper notice, not using proper addresses, and the individual never gets notification that they're supposed to go to court for the discovery. So it's a hardship, and yet it is popping up across the country. An arrest warrant gets issued and people may not even know about it. And the lawsuit may not have really, in fact, supposed to have been against them, some person with a similar name. So this is an area of great and growing concern. You may get a default judgment against you, but you need to do the discovery to let them know that you have ABC, whatever it's worth, and in most cases, for example, in Iowa, those things are going to be exempt anyway and they can't be touched, except, of course, if you have an employment check that can get garnished unless you're making very, very little. So today I want to talk a little bit about the people who are collecting the debt, what's behind the badge, from Debtor's Hell series of articles in the Boston Globe. The debt collectors, they have the power to take your car, your money, and sometimes your freedom, as I just discussed. And they bring some uncommon credentials to the job. And of course, this is from a highlight in an article. Consider these resume highlights. Kenneth Dorsey, manager of Jamaica Plain Gin Mill, ran illegal gaming operation, busted by Boston police, rifle and shotgun confiscated, guilty plea, 1994. Kevin J. Dalton, Plymouth County deputy sheriff until 2001, fired after state police probe into alleged shakedown of a company seeking a contract with the sheriff's department, an accusation he denies. Constance M. Sorensen, filed for bankruptcy in 2003 with $47,000 in delinquent credit card debt, fined for punching a woman in the mouth outside a bar, arrest warrant pending for failure to pay $100 fine in another case. Along with that, baggage, Sorensen, Dalton, and Dorsey also carry badges. As officers of the murkiest backwater of the Massachusetts law enforcement community, they earn their keep as constables, independent contractors appointed by cities and towns to serve court papers and execute court orders. In Boston alone, there are about 190 of them, and Mayor Thomas Marino has given arrest powers to everyone, including Dorsey and 87 others with criminal arrest records for offenses, including firearms violations, indecent assault, and battery on a child, and impersonating a police officer. Seven have been appointed in spite of guilty verdicts, among them one convicted twice in the last 4 years of beating his wife. Now, this is scary. Constables are an odd, anachronistic leftover from colonial days. No training is required, no oversight is provided, and no state agency keeps track of their identities, much less their numbers, an estimated 1,500 to 2,000 statewide in Massachusetts. Yet many of them, including Dorsey, Dalton, and Sorensen, are foot soldiers for the most aggressive debt collectors in Massachusetts. They make their money by night, or at the first light, with a frightening thump on the door, seizing cars by the thousands from intimidated debtors who have missed or ignored court orders to pay their creditors. Most constables prefer to knock politely during daylight hours to deliver subpoenas and the like for $35 to $40 for their fee. But their more aggressive colleagues do much, much better than that. Thanks to a 1990 amendment to the Massachusetts state law, that allows them to charge whatever they like for auto seizures. The result is price gouging. Constables charge debtors between $600 and $900 to accompany the tow truck that arrives to hook a car. The fee used to be capped at $25. When debtors cannot raise the cash to pay the debt and the seizure fees, their cars are sold at auction. Here again, the constables are part of the game. Proceeds of the auction are split among the constable, the tow lot, and the creditor. Almost always ignored, the Globe found, is a state law requiring that the first $700 of the sale proceeds be returned to the debtors. In this obscure trade, constables have some well-armed competitors, the county deputy sheriffs who sit one short rung up the law enforcement ladder and have grabbed an increasing share of the business. For sheriffs, too, the pursuit of a payout can sometimes take precedence over fairness. In one case earlier this year, two deputy sheriffs in Worcester County threatened to arrest a woman who stood between them and her car, waving bankruptcy papers that should have exempted it from seizure. Nevertheless, she lost her car for 10 weeks. Since 2001, sheriff's departments in just five counties, Worcester, Norfolk, Bristol, Plymouth, and Middlesex, have seized about 2,500 cars for debt collectors, most often for a fee of $600 per car. And like constables, they rarely tell debtors they are entitled to the first $700 from the sale of the seized auto. And I'll continue in a minute. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So let's continue looking behind the badge. Maria Loconte had her close encounter with constables shortly after midnight during the summer when her doorbell rang. Loconte, 41, made her way down the stairs from her second-floor apartment and found three men wearing blue uniforms and badges. "They looked like police officers. I thought they were," Loconte said. One of them, she recalls, was tapping his nightstick in the palm of his hand, while another informed her they were there to seize her 1997 Ford Thunderbird for an unpaid credit card debt. "Don't argue with us," she heard him say. Terrified, Loconte said she called Taunton police, who offered little sympathy. The constable brandishing the nightstick was playing by the rules. She says she was told as long as he didn't hit her with it. "I didn't sleep all that night. I couldn't stop crying. I was shaking," Loconte said. Loconte is disabled as a result of lupus and Crohn's disease. She lost her cleaning business more than a decade ago, and by 2000 had stopped making payments on a $430 Providian credit card balance. She wound up paying $1,758, draining her savings and borrowing from a friend to erase the debt and get her car back. Of that, $158 went to the tow lot, which kept her car for a day, and $800 to the constables. To ransom the car, Loconte had to drive 70 miles to Sorensen's office in Chelmsford to pay her bill, then another 55 miles to a Bridgewater tow lot. For Jean Marie Fitzpatrick, the constable's visit was even more costly. An $800 constable fee would have seemed a bargain to her. When Dorsey, the former bar manager turned constable, arrived at her door in December, he demanded $1,250 in fees for seizing her 2000 Dodge Neon. Fitzpatrick, a 37-year-old single mother who lives in South Boston's D Street public housing project, was about to drive her three children to school when Dorsey drove up and blocked her car. Fitzpatrick figured it must be something to do with unpaid parking tickets. She said she had no idea that there were court judgments against her for two delinquent credit card accounts, totaling $3,800. That's because Norfolk Financial Corp., the debt collector who sued Fitzpatrick, had given the court the wrong address. She says she was never notified of the lawsuit, and a Globe check of the court and public records shows she was right. "They went out of their way to find my car, but they didn't go through the trouble to find my address, to notify me about the lawsuit," Fitzpatrick said. "That's what kills me." Dorsey, she said, turned aside her tearful plea that he wait to take her car until she could drop the children at school. Dorsey's fee for having her car hauled away was $625. But since he was holding two pieces of legal paper for taking just one car, he demanded $1,250. The car was sold at auction for just $1,000, even though it had a resale value of about $4,000. "It was a week before Christmas. I have three kids," Fitzpatrick said. "These people have absolutely no
heart.
Dorsey asked in an interview why he demanded twice the normal $625 fee, said it was two different cases. If he had handled them separately, Dorsey contended, he would have been justified in seizing her car twice. I explained everything to her, Dorsey said. I'm not out to screw people. The office of constable is as ancient as it is obscure, governed in Massachusetts by laws that date back to the 1600s. One power of the office, never repealed, is to take due notice of and prosecute all violations of law respecting the observance of the Lord's Day, profane swearing, and gambling. Nowadays, constables and the deputy sheriffs who perform parallel work busy themselves delivering subpoenas and other court papers, placing liens on real estate, and seizing personal property to satisfy court judgments, in the case of constables, judgments of no more than $2,500. Where they differ is in accountability. Constables, for example, can legally operate only in the communities that license them, but that restriction, the Globe found, is often ignored. Constables also largely operate in secret. There is no requirement for them to keep or submit to scrutiny records of their seizures. When the Globe set out to determine how many cars constables across the state have seized from debtors, almost all those asked refused to say. Records held by county sheriffs, by contrast, are public. But what is clear, by the account of sheriffs, debt collectors, and constables themselves, is that it is constables who handle the bulk of car seizures. Court records suggest their totals run to several thousand cars a year across the state of Massachusetts. Sorensen's firm alone was seizing between 80 and 100 cars a month for two debt collection companies, according to affidavits filed in a court case involving the companies. And Dalton, who owns South Coast Legal Services, told the Globe he uses constables around the state as subcontractors to seize vehicles, though he refused to say how many cars they hook for him. One of his subcontractors, Dorsey, who took away Fitzpatrick's car, said he seizes between 12 and 30 cars a month. And no one monitors their work. So little scrutinized are constables that some work with impunity in communities where they have no jurisdiction. Sorensen, for example, represents herself as a constable, but her license in Salem expired in 2003. In an interview, Sorensen, 37, claimed to be a constable in Lynn and Medford in addition to Salem. But officials in Lynn and Medford say they have no record she has ever been licensed to serve in either city. Sorensen has also been embroiled in legal disputes for dispatching constables to do seizures in communities where they were unlicensed. And some constables who worked for her have been criticized for over-the-top tactics. One allegedly identified himself as a state police officer, according to court papers filed, in a lawsuit against a debt collector. Another constable allegedly threatened a debtor with criminal sanctions, even though debt collection is a civil matter. There's not one heavy-handed constable that I've ever worked with, Sorensen insisted. She reached a confidential settlement in the earlier case, which she declined to discuss with the Globe. She said she's now stopped seizing cars altogether, but last summer, Sorensen identified herself as a constable when she seized two cars from a Grafton businessman. Sorensen defended the work of constables. She said, consumers who ignored court orders to pay their debts have no right to complain when the constables come calling, no matter the hour. She described her own work as 9 to 5, meaning 9 at night until 5 in the morning. I think you should pay those debts, especially consumer debt. You can't take a credit card and go buy yourself a new television and expect to never have to pay for it. But people do, Sorensen said. I think everyone should be responsible. I do. I'm responsible. Not quite. A Globe review of federal bankruptcy files showed that Sorensen has twice filed for bankruptcy, most recently in 2003, when her credit card debts alone exceeded $47,000. After that, her lawyer sued her for not paying his fee and won a court judgment, along with authorization to have her car seized, but he decided against taking that step. Sorensen sidestepped questions about her own financial problems, except to say, defendants aren't all bad. They're like me and you. And I will continue on with this journey into debt collection next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipitak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeindebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.